Welcome, welcome, your Backup Plan tribe, to another awesome show today. Our show today is called Secrets of Mental Illness, Debbie's Inspiring Battle for Her Son's Life. I think that is going to be a story that needs to be told everywhere, honestly. It is so much in the news these days, and for Debbie, it was just about 10 years ago, and it's still prevalent today, and it's being more noticed today, and it's a pain for the family, it's painful for the mom and dad, and it's just painful for the friends, and there's just no clear answers of what we can do. So that being said, welcome to our show today. You have reached Tina at Your Backup Plan podcast, and I am your sponsor today from Your Backup Plan. That's the only sponsors we have of our program. I'm the creator and developer of Your Backup Plan app. I'm a best-selling author of In the Blink of an Eye. Just like that, your life changes in a second. And anybody that has gone through something traumatic and tragic, they know what that feels like. Getting that cancer word, or having a car accident, or a work accident, or a quick death, anything like that, or a wildfire and you're not given any evacuation notice. It's that quick second where your life changes. And so I had to create a backup plan for people. And that's what I did. I put it all in one safe place for everybody to be able to reach it and use it. Medical information, end of life stuff, disability, sickness, anything like that, wildfires and earthquakes. And I'm also a financial advisor and an emergency preparedness coach. And that's what got me into this whole field. And my passion to help people is definitely there. We are on all podcast platforms, YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Pinterest. And so if you want to watch us on any of our other platforms, feel free to. Our wonderful guest today is going to hang out in our backstage. We'll be right back after this quick. Welcome back, Your Backup Plan tribe, to our Your Backup Plan podcast. And our special guest today is Debbie Gale, and she comes to us from beautiful Virginia. I'm just going to bring her on and introduce her. Welcome, welcome, Debbie.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Tina.
Awesome. Now, Debbie is an author. She just completed her book, so we need to give her a standing ovation for finally getting that finished. I know what that's like. And she is a life coach with Debbie Gale Coaching. And our story, I'll mention your book, Finding Peace and Purpose Amidst the Tears, My Journey of Love and Loss of My Son Through His Mental Illness and Addiction. I know it's not all the whole title, but I think it talks to everybody that has been anywhere close to anything like this happening. There we go. That's perfect. Yeah, my finding peace and purpose. You can really see that. It stands out in the book. So, Debbie, where did all this start for you? You know, I interviewed you about a year and a half ago, and I'll make sure I link down below. Make sure you like, share, and subscribe to our channel. And I will link in the description box your previous podcast that we had you on our show. And now that you've written this book, I think that you'll have a lot of tips and tricks for us here with parents and family members that are going through this exact thing. So where did it all start for you?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
You started with the book now. Yeah. But
so when I was on your show last year, I was in the process of writing it. I had lost my oldest son at the beginning of January of 2022. And not too long after, I started writing a book to help other parents so that, because I will just mention my son. About 9 years before he passed away, he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, and he shortly thereafter became addicted to drugs and alcohol. So I was writing my book to help other parents so that they wouldn't feel alone and they would have hope for peace and healing and the inspiration to go on. Because when you are in that situation, a lot of times you feel so alone.
Sure do.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. So 9 years before he passed away, he came to me one day out of the blue and told me about being suicidal, told me he had a plan, told me he had attempted suicide, described exactly what he did. And that moment, I will never forget. And as
a
parent, you
must have felt like throwing up.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, it's like the worst thing that you want to hear as a parent is that your child has tried to kill themselves. And I didn't, at that time, I didn't know that there was any kind of depression or suicidal thoughts or mental illness. Like, this was where it all started to me. And it, shortly after that, he was hospitalized for 3.5 weeks, that first hospitalization, which was a big deal. And I remember going back and forth for the visitation and it just feeling so hard. It was like life stopped and you just lived for the visitation and, you know, communications with the doctors, family meetings with the doctor and the social worker and my son. And, you know, that was life. Like your whole rest of your life just stopped. And
all of a sudden.
And it was really profound. And having him hospitalized for 3.5 weeks was a really long time for us. It was hard on me. It was hard on his two siblings. I have another son and a daughter, and all three of them were really close. And I remember a few weeks after he was hospitalized, we were hoping he'd be home in time for my daughter's birthday to celebrate. And unfortunately, he wasn't. And her birthday didn't feel the same to her because we were used to all, the four of us always celebrating together. And it was really hard. And that was just the beginning of
the whole journey.
Yes, years of battle with the illness, with learning that he had started using drugs, and the drug use escalated, and it just, everything got worse. You know, there, it was a journey of challenges, a journey of arguments, where we didn't used to really have arguments and disagreements before that. He was kind of an easygoing child, and this was a big change for us.
Yeah, and then it causes drama and bad energy amongst the family unit as well with the other kids, right?
Yeah, it was hard because a lot of energy had to be used towards dealing with what was going on with him, towards the crises, and there were so many. I know he was diagnosed at age 17. And I would say the rest of the teen years and the early 20s, I almost lost him so many times. There were numerous scares with drug overdoses. And my daughter was with me for a lot of them because my other son was away at college for some of those years. But
yeah,
it was really tough. There were so many times that I was just praying, like, please, you know, please don't let him go now, please don't. And you know, he would manage to be okay. And I share some of these, I share in my book, so I share a lot of these stories that I went through and how I dealt with them. And the reason I share the stories is because I know for me as a parent, I felt so alone. I looked around me and everybody else's life seemed normal. It seemed like they had a normal family, normal kids that were doing normal things. And I felt like I was the only one going through this. And it was really hard. I felt isolated. I did go to a support group. I went to Al-Anon, which was really helpful. I also read a lot of articles and did a little bit with NAMI, which is the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And so I did have support, which was really helpful, but I still felt alone. I still had like other friends out there who seemed to have normal kids, normal lives. And mine was a series of...
They can't relate to that.
Yeah. Mine was a series of the next shoe dropping and an emergency in the middle of the night and a phone call from the hospital that my son arrived and he's overdosed and he may not make it. And he's in the ICU. And, you know, this was life. Is even if things were going smooth, I was on edge. And so I knew that I needed to find a way to be able to enjoy the time I had with him and not to be on edge all the time, not to live in fear. Because I spent the first few years living in fear, and that impacted my relationship with him. It impacted my health. It impacted a lot. And I knew that there had to be a better way. I knew that there had to be a way to have peace in my life and to maintain that really good relationship with him and to be able to be present for him.
Do you think, Debbie, is after going through all this, do you think there's any way for anybody listening out there that have a child of some age going through this? Do you think that there's some hope for some to be able to clear away the addictions and get on the better road of health and success for themselves, like to be a person who's got some sort of career in mind, or like the norm, if you want to put it that way? Do you think that's something that people can hope for? Is there some ability to change this? It's like a spiraling whirlwind that you lived in, you know, where it seems okay and then it's not, and then it seems okay and then it's not, like a constant.
I think it is important to hold that space of hope for your child. I really do. But what you don't want to be in is you don't want to have this expectation where you're pinning all your happiness to he has to do this. And if he gets better and he does all these things, then I'm going to feel okay. Then I'm going to feel happy. Then I'm going to feel at peace. Then he or she and I are going to be close. You don't want to pin those things on that. But it's definitely, I think it's really good thing to hold the hope for them, to hold that space, to believe in them, to believe that it is possible for them. And my son did have phases where he was off drugs and off alcohol and on his medications for his illness and doing better. And it was kind of, it's kind of an up and down kind of thing. And they warned me about that in that first hospitalization. They said that a lot of times with this illness, they'll start to feel better and they'll go off their meds and they'll end up self-medicating. And, you know, it's kind of a cycle like that. And so, but there are many out there who do find sobriety and who do stay on meds and who are doing really well. And everybody's different. And it's just so important to love our child and love ourself through it all, through whatever is happening, like whether it's the high or whether it's the low or anything in between, because when we're waiting for it to be great before we, you know, do whatever, before we improve our relationship or before we allow ourselves to be happy, if we wait, we might really miss out on a lot of opportunities and a lot of memories that we would cherish. And we would just, we never know how long anybody has, whether it's us or another person. And so we don't want to be waiting for something, and we don't want to have this huge expectation. But that's so different from hope, like holding out hope that and believing in our child is something really positive that we can do for them.
Do you think that it's changed in this 10-year window for hope for parents, that they've made some progression in that type of, because it's somehow happening to 17 to 24 year olds, males mostly and some females, but something happens, and I'm not sure about the mental illness that comes out of it, but everybody seems to be in that same sort of condition, I guess, where they go to drugs and alcohol and they go to doing this kind of behavior. And I guess I have to wonder if we're making any progress with that, if yeah. you've seen any progress in the last 10 years.
That's such a good question. And I know that there are things that I wished that I realized back when my son was diagnosed, or even over the years, that I realize now is our health actually plays a role in it. Our health plays a role in addictions and in mental illnesses in ways that I didn't know back then. And I really wish I had more information about it when he was diagnosed, and maybe I could have done something differently. Maybe health-wise, we could have done a different path. We could have perhaps done better healthy eating, different supplements. We could have done something, but I didn't really know. I didn't understand the causes of mental illness. And I think it's not fully really accepted what the causes are. I think some people yeah. say it's just, we don't know why. I think some people can say that there could be a genetic component. I'm not really sure about that. I mean, my son did have an uncle on his dad's side that had schizophrenia, or maybe it was his great uncle, but I'm still not sure that it's actually genetic. I think it has a lot to do with toxins in our body. That's what I think.
Is that right?
That's what I've learned now. But I unfortunately didn't have this knowledge when he was living.
So what could parents do that would change maybe a bit of that component if you were to go back 10 years ago, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, so if I was to go back 10 years ago, for my own personal health, I've actually been following medical medium information, and I've healed a lot of things. And so what I've learned is that you can actually heal addiction and mental illness. And it has to do with your brain. And it has to do with toxins. It has. So what I would do is what I've been following the past few years for myself, for my own health, for other health issues, I would have helped him in those ways. I guess
yeah.
it would have been helpful to have that knowledge when I was raising him when he was a child, because then it kind of would have been part of his reality. Maybe it's a little harder when they're already a young adult and they have their own yeah. ideas what they want to do and not do, and you don't always see eye to eye on things. So I feel like had I known this information, say, when he was in his 20s, it still might have been hard to convince him to follow it. But had I had the information when he was a young child, then I would have raised him that way. And I think that yeah. it would have been a different life. And it does make me sad when I think about that. But I can't know. And this is for any parent out there that is like regretting something that they did or didn't do, is we can only do the best we can with what we know now, and we can't go back in time. And so there's no use to beat ourselves up about it.
Not especially when you don't know. You know, it's things yeah. you just don't know. And I mean, I would say even professionals don't really quite know yet. So, I mean, it's all just a big guessing game.
No, they don't. I mean, what
but
I
at least it's more out there.
It's
at least
definitely
it's more out there now, you know?
It's much more out there. I mean, what I was told when he was diagnosed is that he would need medication to stop symptoms such as suicidal thoughts, hallucinations, paranoia, and that, you know, if he found the right combination of medicines, then, you know, that would be helpful for him. But I was told that, I was basically told there was no cure and no way for him to get better, but it was up to, you know, him to, you know, do things like taking medication. I mean, I was basically just told that you need to take this medication. And you know, sometimes it's hard for people who have mental health issues to stay on it, because I think it has side effects. I know that he complained of side effects, so it was hard for him.
What kind of side effects did he find?
I think it made him tired. He said it made him feel not like himself, like it wasn't him going about his day doing things. It was like somebody else. I guess what he was maybe trying to describe is maybe some sort of depersonalization. We did find that some medications actually made him worse. So it took a few years to get the right medications. I mean, in the end, there were some medications that were able, if he stayed on him, they would stop the paranoia and they would stop the hallucinations.
Did you ever experience them with him?
Experience what?
Those experiences of paranoia and schizophrenia.
So, I mean, I remember before I even knew what he had, when we were going to the hospital, that first hospital stay, and he was in the hospital many, many times, but that first day, I remember they told us to come back in an hour for his intake interview, and I went to go take him to get some food, and he started telling me that about things that he was paranoid about. He didn't use those words, but he basically told me how in his room that he had in my home at the time, that he had put coverings over the windows because people were spying on him. Faces, and
Hold on, I lost you for a sec.
And at the hospital,
there we go, you're back.
Yeah, and then at the hospital, he told me that he could not put the socks on. They take your shoes because you can't have laces. You can't have anything that could tie and you could use to strangle yourself. And so they gave him these hospital socks, and he said he couldn't wear them because they had cameras to spy on him. And it kind of went on and off for years, the paranoia. And I could always tell, even in the years where he didn't live with me, if he would call me and he would start to talk about things, I would know exactly what medication he was on, off, and I would ask him, are you still on this medication? And he would say, oh no, I ran out. And you know, it was always I ran out and I haven't been able to go get more kind of a thing. And then the hallucinations I had also, that was really scary. I remember when he first got out of the hospital from that first long stay, a couple of days later, he came to me really shaken up, and he was basically seeing and hearing things.
And that must be frustrating.
It was really hard, and he was really upset. It was because he would point, and there was nothing there, but he was really scared.
Wow, can you imagine just going through that in your own head?
Yeah, I can't even imagine, because I've not had to live with these things. It was hard for me as a parent, but what I see, what I've realized now after losing him, is that how strong he was. Not strong in his ability to take care of himself, but strong in his ability to endure everything that he had to endure day after day. His life was not easy at all.
And did he notice the change way back when? Do you think he noticed all of a sudden a switch turned?
It's a good question. I'm not sure if there was a specific day or time. It's really odd. I know that he first came to me, it was the day after Thanksgiving. And so it was a holiday weekend. And he was in his senior year in high school at the time. And the beginning of the year, he had been running track and cross country throughout high school. And he did do the first, I think it was cross country, was the sport that started in August, and it probably ended mid-November. So he was finished with that. And from what I saw, things appeared normal. I didn't know that there was anything wrong until he came to me that night. But I don't know when the switch, like what happened within him, you know? He was,
yeah.
I know, yeah, not sure.
To think that in when I talk about in the blink of an eye, things can happen, you would never think that somebody's personality could change in the blink of an eye either. Like, it's just, it's unfathomable to understand, you know?
Yeah, and that's just such a good way to describe it, because that's kind of what it is. It's in a blink of an eye. It's like one moment you're just going about the way your life had been on this same course, and
yeah,
and then when suddenly your child comes to you and describes how they would like to kill themselves and how they've tried, and you know in that moment that life has changed. Life is not the same.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder what happens exactly. And so many go into an addiction with it too. I wonder why. Is that to make them feel better?
So what I was told at the hospital and from his psychiatrist and counselors kind of over the years is, and also at treatment centers, when he went into rehab centers, I was told that many times they go hand in hand, because many times they self-medicate. The symptoms are really bad with the mental illness and they cannot deal with it. And so taking the drugs or the alcohol is their escape. So that's what I was told. I also think that it's similar toxins in the brain. What I learned now is that it's similar toxins in the brain that cause addiction can also cause mental illness and vice versa. So it's not surprising that they both go hand in hand. But I definitely think it offers some sort of a break for the mentally ill when they are doing that. Although I think that it makes the illness worse. It definitely doesn't help, because, you know, drugs are not healthy for us, right? They're damaging for our health. And usually it worsens things. And I do think in the later years, to some degree, his other health issues got worse. He had a seizure disorder, and I think the drugs really worsened that. He also had type 1 diabetes, and the drugs also worsened that. So unfortunately, all of his health issues over the years were just getting a lot worse.
Wow. Was he happy, though, do you think? Are they normally happy when you're dealing with this? Or is it all a big, angry, drama-filled environment?
That's such a great question. And I feel like every person is really different. And I think at times my son was angry, but there were times that he found happiness. So he was a really unique individual, and he loved a few things throughout his whole life. And I think they became really important in his years of illness. And that one thing he loved was family. So he would just, you know, in his later years when we weren't all living together, he'd get so excited when we all had a plan to get together. And that made him happy. He also loved religion. And I think it wasn't one certain religion that we could say, okay, he was this religion. He's really been almost every religion out there. But he would really delve into it and study it in depth. and learn about it. And if there was baptism as a sacrament, he would get baptized, he'd learn everything. And, you know, he could be one religion anywhere from a few months to years. But I think it gave him happiness. I think it gave him acceptance. He felt accepted. I think it helped him a lot. And I do think religion, he found some happiness. So religion, family. He also loved to study genetics. He started that as a young age. So certain things, but I think that life was hard for him. I don't think he was at peace. I think life was really hard. He was in and out of hospitals. He was in and out of treatment centers. He was, we almost lost him a number of times of drug overdoses. He, you know, got into difficult situations.
Do you think on purpose or just by chance?
No, just by chance. I think he wanted life to go well and he wanted life to be smooth, but I think just he wasn't able to do it. And even though in the later years he wasn't against taking his medications, he would end up, you know, just not renewing them, not refilling them in time. And it just kind of made for a roller coaster. And the last time though that he spent time with my other children and myself, which was a few days before he passed away, he was completely sober. And I think that was the first time we had seen him completely sober in a really long time. And he also seemed really, really happy that day. And I think we all thought that that was the happiest we had seen him in a while.
I think Robin Williams was kind of like that. A lot of people, even older individuals I've heard, you know, whether they're in their late 80s or 90s, and you see them thinking, oh, they're better now. You know, they're so much better and such a bigger, better look of them. And they're acting better and they look better. And then all of a sudden it just drops. I don't understand why that happens, but
I think
it must have been what you guys experienced.
I think it's the nature of mental illness and addiction. I think it is just kind of it's like that. And that's why I was saying is that you have to just be present for the moments that you have with your child. You know, you have to just, you can't have these expectations where, okay, this needs to happen first before, you know, I take steps to have a repair my relationship with them. Because a lot of times I find with other parents is that the relationship breaks down. There's a lot of arguing going on. There's just a lot of difficulties in the family. It can be hard on the siblings. And so this, you know, but to say that I'm going to wait for something to be positive, for my child to be doing better before things get better, I don't think that's a good thing. I think that you want to have this unconditional love. You want to have this really strong love for them and this really strong connection with them through all of it, through when it is up and when it is down, because it will be up and down.
Yeah, I think that's true. And so many go into rehab so many times. And I think of Amy Winehouse and so many. And look at Michael Jackson even. You wonder, you know, what he had to struggle in his life so much. And so many of them are doing such wonderful work in the world, and musicians or actors and comedians, and it's them and it's the regular person that's behind that closed door that is exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's crazy, because did they ever tell you that if he kept on going? How old was he when he passed away?
He was 26 and a half.
So if he had of kept going on this route Do you always have to be on edge all the time? It doesn't matter if you think, you know, like you've got it beat.
No, so that's the thing. That's what I share. That's part of the reason for sharing my story in my book, is not just sharing the story for parents to not feel alone, but what my path to peace was, because I knew that I needed to find a way to live at peace, to not be on edge all the time, because that fear can just eat at you.
Yeah.
So much. I mean, otherwise you're having sleepless nights, especially because I remember sometimes I would get calls in the middle of the night. Or I remember one time he came home and he was on something, and he came up to my room at 3 a.m. and he's, you know, fumbled to say the words, "I crashed my car." And I went out and I looked at his car, and it was almost unbelievable that a person could have walked out of that car, like, without a scratch. Like, unbelievable somebody could have survived it, not to mention walked out of the car without a scratch. But there were just so many scares in the middle of the night. So if I let myself, I would have never slept. I would have just continued to live in that fear, waiting for the next shoe to drop. But I knew that there had to be another way. I knew I couldn't change him, because we can't change another person.
No.
But we can change things about ourselves. We can change what things mean to us, how we choose to live our lives. We can change things around our thoughts. So we do have control over those types of things. And so I was able to find peace for myself.
I think it's so important, because how are you going to be normal for your other children, normal for your own life, and normal for your job? Like, that's like, you are, moms do split themselves up in so many pieces of the pie, you know, and if you don't have that under control, you're just a big mess yourself.
I think that's what happens a lot. I think that, you know, parents go through a really difficult struggle where, even if they are able to, you know, run around to sporting events for their other children and run to their jobs, and but they're still struggling inside. There's just still that fear. Their health deteriorates. They're not sleeping. They're not enjoying. There's no joy. They're not enjoying their other children. They're not enjoying the child that has the illness. They're just not enjoying anything. They're not present at all. They're pretty much just going through the motions and living in the what ifs.
I think it's so much because it's just like, didn't you feel like your head is just full? Like, when you're going through all of these different things, it's just like every time it just keeps adding to it, and then pretty soon your head feels like it's going to explode. And yeah. I think, I don't know how to explain it, but it's hard to work. It's hard to just think of peace. And I think that's where, like, what you're saying is you have to come to some sort of terms with it to be able to find peace in that messed up world that you're living in.
Absolutely.
I guess you'd call it that.
Yeah, I think that it comes, well, what I learned is that a lot of the fear comes from wanting a sense of certainty. So wanting certainty that things are going to happen the way you want them to happen, the way you think that they need to happen. And so when it doesn't, and it continues not to, then you feel worse, and you just keep holding on to that certainty. So I had to really make certainty not such a big priority for me. That was part of the thing that I did in my path to peace, is downgrading certainty and that need for certainty, but also meeting my need for certainty in other ways. And I still find that in difficult times, that need for certainty can resurface. Like, for example, when I first lost my son, I remember getting together after the funeral. I got together with my other children. We all spent time together right after the funeral, and not wanting to leave to go home, like wanting that certainty that they're going to be okay, that nothing can possibly happen to them now. And I felt that fear coming back, and I hadn't had that fear. I hadn't lived with that fear in so many years. And so I realized what it was. I realized it was that need for certainty. And I realized that I had to put certainty in its place. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to enjoy my life. And I have a beautiful relationship with my other two children too. And I had a beautiful one with my son that passed away. But you're not going to be able to enjoy it if you just get caught up in the fear.
But I guess the first step, of course, is to recognize that's what you're doing to yourself. You're creating that fear within yourself and the uncertainty. So if you could recognize that, then you can say, okay, Mr. Fear, you go to that corner of the room, and uncertainty, you go over there. And I want to live my life. You know, I guess if you start talking to them like they're an entity and that you don't want to have any parts of them and go away, maybe that might help. I don't know, but I think recognizing it might be helpful first.
You've got to recognize what you're doing. And it's important to recognize that the reason you're having that fear is because your need for certainty is so high. And so for me, I know I substituted other things for certainty. So I substituted, I know I learned from Tony Robbins that we've got these six human needs. Certainty is one of them. And he says, if we make certainty our top need, we'll never be happy. Because think about it. If we're needing the outside world to be certain, that's never going to happen. It's just never going to happen. So we're never going to be happy. So I had to learn to substitute another need. And for me, a big one was contribution. At the time, you know, when my son was first diagnosed, I was going to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. And I think that was my first way of contributing to others, is I ended up getting more from the meetings when I was doing service, when I was sponsoring somebody, when I was becoming a group representative, when I was volunteering at some of the conferences and organizations, when I was doing things to help other people, that was helping me. And I think that for me, contribution was such a big one. And that was what motivated me to first become a life and relationship coach years ago, was that need to serve others, that need to help other people beyond myself. And that helped me so much. And it's also helped me after losing my son as well, that contribution.
Oh, that's a great tip. Quick mention, Debbie's information for her book is down below, so don't forget that. And click like and share, because I know that you must know somebody, if you're watching this, that could use these tips from Debbie. You know, like, we're all here to help just one person, Debbie and I. Every time we go on a show, we would just want to help one person. And if we can do that, then we've done our deed for today, I guess you could say. That's what I always feel like, just helping somebody. Could you tell the listeners how he did pass away? Because your previous video is down below as well. But how did he pass away? And did you ever? And like you said, he was really good, and then something happened. So tell us more about that.
Yeah. So we don't actually have a clear answer, unfortunately. After he passed away, when he first passed away, I received the call that he was found dead, and
was he living on his own then?
He was, yeah.
He was living on his own, and he seemed fine, like you said.
Right. I had seen him. So we had all gotten together January 1st, where I was living at the time, out in the country, and my other kids and their partners came over. And for New Year's Day, and Alex came, and he actually had a girlfriend at the time, but a new girlfriend that he met when he was out walking about a month prior. And it turns out she had a similar mental illness to him, but she wasn't able to make it. So he came with my other kids, and they all came out, and we all spent the day together. And it was lovely. We definitely didn't know that was a Saturday. We didn't know that Thursday we would get that call. And so I received a phone call at 9 a.m. from the police, and there had been a big snowstorm, and I was living about an hour away. So apparently they usually come out in person, but they said, you know, with where you live and the snow and all, we're sorry to have to do this on the phone. And so they ordered an autopsy report just because he was a young person and there wasn't an obvious cause of death. There was apparently a lot of empty alcohol bottles around, but there were no sign of drugs. And we thought he had been off drugs for a little while being probably at least a few months, but probably not off alcohol, although he wasn't on it the day he came over for our get together. And so I had to wait about 16 weeks for the autopsy report. And when I received
it, that must have been hard.
It was really hard. I had to let go of it. And I also had to, in my mind, I feel like there are so many people who are living who don't have answers for their chronic health symptoms. So part of me thought that, well, if they don't have answers for the living, they may not have an exact answer for somebody who's deceased. So I didn't necessarily expect it, but I hoped. I really hoped we'd have an answer because I really, really wanted an answer. It felt really, really confusing. Like he's doing better, he's happier, he has a girlfriend, he's sober, he's appears to be on his medications. Like what, you know, what happened and why now? And you know, he survived so many overdoses. Like I thought he would keep going, and you know, so it was a lot. And when I got the autopsy report and I first read it, I did not understand, because all it said was alcoholism and diabetes. And I thought, well, he's had alcoholism and diabetes now for quite some time, and he's been living all this time, so this is not a cause of death. So I called, and thankfully the medical examiner was able to speak with me, and she said that they don't know exactly what happened, but he had a condition in his body at the time of death called hyponatremia, which can be swelling of tissues and cells, especially in the brain and other organs. When it does that, it can cause death. And it could be caused by alcoholism, in that if he had had a lot to drink and then was off of it, his body could have gone through a withdrawal, because there was no alcohol found in his blood. There was no drugs other than his medications found in his blood. But it was also, he had passed away the day before. So I don't know how long things take to get out of your blood. She said that it's kind of frozen in time, and it doesn't matter if they're doing the autopsy after the fact. I don't really know. So I don't have exact answers. We don't know what happened. Something to his system caused the hyponatremia, probably caused swelling in his brain, and it may have caused a stroke or a heart attack is what happens. And
kind of like a seizure or something, right? Kind of idea.
Right. And he did,
when they have withdrawals, right, or something.
And he did also have a seizure disorder, and she knew about that. She did do her homework really well. She had all his medical records. She knew about his history and all of his, you know, she really had done her homework. She said it's possible that every once in a while something can happen from a seizure disorder, but it's not as likely. It's more likely that there was something related to like a withdrawal from the alcohol. I do know that diabetes could have been a factor in there with the alcohol, because in his last few years of his life, I think because of all the drugs and alcohol, his diabetes was not doing well at all. In fact, there were, I don't even know how many, countless hospitalizations where he would arrive at the hospital almost in a diabetic coma, almost not having made it, his blood sugar off the charts, which means over 900. And
oh my goodness.
He would barely make it there. So I don't really know how
maybe that was eating away at his organs, right?
It could have been. I do know he had some sort of brain damage the last few years, because he would repeat the same things over and over. When we'd get together with him, he would tell us the same stories over and over. And even when an event happened and he'd call me and he'd be sharing it, it was really hard to get the whole story out because he'd keep repeating the same things over and over. And it was really sad because he was a young person. He was only 26 when he passed away, but he had so many health issues.
Poor Alex. Poor guy. Yeah, can only have empathy for somebody who's just gone through so much trauma in his own head, even not even on the outside, but in himself.
Exactly. I know. Terrible. And that's the thing is we did have empathy for him. And yeah. even though things were difficult and there were a lot of struggles and challenges, we had a lot of empathy for him. Life wasn't easy.
Yeah.
Life isn't easy for the parent, but I want the parents to realize that life isn't easy living with mental illness and addiction. It's not easy.
Yeah. Themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we're on the outside of that looking in and thinking, what's the big deal, I guess, for most of us. You know,
right.
You have,
and we're so,
cause I don't know why, yeah. But
right.
You just think, well, you just don't drink, or you just don't do this, or you just, you know, but nothing said about addictions, right? That's why it's called addiction.
Yeah. And he had been to a number of rehabs as well. And each and every time he'd get really caught up in it. And I think he had that same desire to contribute to other people as well, because I know that his counselor, we did a few virtual family meetings because of COVID. He was his last outpatient treatment was virtual instead of like going there during the day. It was kind of like he was inpatient and then afterwards there's like an outpatient program and it was virtual over COVID. And he had this wonderful counselor who he really loved, and we had some virtual meetings, and she said that that he was kind of the role model for the other people. Like, and it's funny because there was this one time that he was with my daughter and I, and I forget, I think that we thought he wasn't drinking or doing drugs, and he admitted he had started drinking alcohol but no drugs, and we said, but you're in this program, you know, you really like that. And he's like, yeah, yeah, but I can't let them know that, because he's like, they look up to me. And so it was really cute. So I think he wanted to do better and he wanted to be better, but I think life was really hard for him.
It sounds like it was really hard for him.
Yeah. And that's why I realized that after he passed away, I realized how strong he is, you know, not strong in his ability to take good care of himself, but strong in his ability to endure everything that he had to go through with his health day in and day out. Because I don't know that I could do it. I mean, we parents think it's hard, but we're not the ones who are inside of them going through it.
Can you imagine all the voices in their heads? You know, just that must be terrible. Must be terrible to have to think you have to endure that. You wake up and you probably think when you wake up, I wish I could just go back to sleep, or, you know, like you just must be terrible.
I really think it's awful. And I know he wasn't at peace. Like I said, he found certain things that gave him joy, like family and religion, but he definitely wasn't living in peace.
Yeah. I hate to end the show because we have so much to talk about with it still, but I will have you come back on, and Debbie and I were talking backstage about having Debbie come back with her her daughter. And I think that would be really awesome for everybody, for listeners to talk to the whole family kind of thing, and find out what was going on with the other children in the family as well. So that would be kind of cool. We're going to talk about that just after the summer. So comment down below if you want to have Debbie come back and talk more about this, because, you know, it just, it's just so much out there of it. What kind of final message do you have for the listeners, Debbie?
Yeah, each moment is precious, and we never know how long us or a loved one has. But we can choose to be present and cherish each opportunity that we are given to be with those we love, living in the moment, because we don't really know whether there is a tomorrow.
Isn't that the truth? Can we say amen to that? Absolutely. I feel like you should be up on a stage saying that, and we could just, you know, all cheer, because that's really what we need to do, is get everybody to be more present. I talk about that all the time. You know, every moment is magic, so make every moment count.
Yeah, because that's the only place that you can have love and connection with your other family members and with your child that's ill. I mean, you can only have it in the present moment. That,
you know. Yeah. Yeah, you just don't know what's up ahead. So yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Debbie, and giving some pointers to everybody. And her book is down below in the description box, so don't forget to check that out. And, you know, everybody, we're not Superman, so don't act like we are, because I know so many of us say, nothing's going to happen, Tina. Yeah, famous last words. Right, Debbie?
Yeah, you never know what life's going to bring your way.
No. And especially nowadays, you know, with the weather and the tornadoes and the hurricanes and the floods and the snow and the just wars, it's just whole bunch of craziness. It really truly is. And so why not have a better plan and be more prepared for the unexpected, like we talk about? So don't forget to hit that like button, smash that button for your girl, and show us that you want to see more of these videos. If you are thinking of that special someone right now, that's while you're watching this show, and you haven't reached out to them for a while, please do. Call them. We still have phones. And you can knock on their door. And you could FaceTime them, or you could Zoom them, whatever it takes to make sure you tell them how much you love and care about them today, because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. So that being said, I hate to end the show, because it's just so interesting. I just love talking to Debbie and finding out the ins and outs of this whole dilemma that just not Debbie's had to deal with. We know that there's probably, what do they say, 1 in 10 families deal with this, do you think?
Oh, I think more.
I think that's what it's at?
Yeah. More than that, yeah. Sometimes 1 in 4.
Wow, that's crazy numbers, you know, yeah. And you're going to be busy for a very long time, Debbie. I hope you're ready for this special ride that you're going on.
I definitely want to bring my message to the world.
Yes, and so do I. I want to bring Debbie's message to the world. So that being said, we will have Debbie come back on with her daughter. I think that will be a great show, and yeah, I don't know what else to say, because we've talked about so much today, and I don't know what the answers are. It doesn't matter if you're a celebrity or the average track teammate. Like, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who you are, what color eyes you have. It doesn't matter whether you're a musician or an actor or, you know, even Twitch, there has to be something going on there with Twitch, what happened to him. All of a sudden, he just wants to kill himself. You know, what's all inside of people we just don't know in their heads, troubling them, what they're struggling with on a daily basis. And they seem fine on the exterior. That's just so how weird it is.
Yeah.
So like Debbie says, be more present, right? Be more present with those moments because you don't know.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, you know, that being said, we always end with Carol Burnett. And I know Debbie's been on our show before. So now I haven't changed this part of my show from the very beginning. I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started. And before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long. So long, everybody. I hope you love Debbie as much as I do. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you, listeners.
Thank you so much for having me as a guest.
You're very welcome, Debbie. I'll have you come back for sure. So make sure you stay safe, everybody. Be kind to others. And till next week, see you soon. Bye.